Off Message is brought to you by The Great Courses Plus, engaging video lectures presented by top university professors on a variety of topics. It's the perfect way to learn for the pure pleasure of learning. With Great Courses Plus, you have unlimited access to a wealth of knowledge. Watch lectures from any device on your own schedule. Sign up today and get your first month free. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. Hey, everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast. A note on my voice, I have the Philly flu. I and about 50% of the press corps that covered the convention in Philadelphia, Democratic convention, got the worst head cold ever, so I apologize if I sound like I'm underwater. Well, this is a podcast unlike really anything we've ever done before, just in the way that it went down. We brought Senator Chris Murphy, the freshman from Connecticut, a guy who has made his name by filibustering on gun control on the Senate floor, was kind of an unknown guy. Also was senator when the terrible Newtown shootings took place and really worked with the families there. We had him for kind of like a drive-by sit-down, just like a 20-minute interview. And it turned out after we started engaging with him that we needed to really spend a lot more time on this. And let me explain to you my evolution in the middle of this podcast. You will notice my tone of my questioning at the beginning of this thing is really skeptical and bordering on hostile. The reason for that is I was really wondering whether or not this dude, who was very young, really felt committed to this as a cause, or if he saw this as a vehicle for his own advancement in the Senate. We would not know who Chris Murphy is, folks, if it wasn't for the filibuster. And we were right in the middle of this convention. Things were moving fast. We were very much in the mindset of thinking about stuff in very cold political terms. And in the course of the interview, something pretty interesting happened. Murphy talked about this cause, gun control, in terms that I'd never really heard a politician use before. He admitted to me, again, I never heard a politician talk this way, that he was kind of directionless in the Senate in his first couple of years as a junior senator, that he didn't really have a reason to get up in the morning and go do his job. I mean, that's something, you'll hear from your friends in a bar. You don't really hear politicians make that kind of confession. And it took me a while for it to sink in for me. But I really think he was authentic on this. And we decided, Bridget and I decided, to not push this thing out in the middle of the convention where it would be lost, but to take it and put it on a week when it would be sort of a tonic, when it would serve as a little bit of a counterpoint to the negativity in the news. And this is the week that Trump imploded. His poll numbers, he's dropping in his poll numbers like a gangster in cement shoes. There's just a lot of negativity in the air. And I just thought that this particular interview with Chris Murphy, whether you agree with him or not, shows a little different side of what a politician could be. And gives you a little different sense of how aspirational this business can be when somebody takes it the way that I think Murphy has. But you be the judge. Maybe my initial skepticism was right, but by the end of this interview, I was convinced that this is a guy who really feels it. Anyway, a bit of business here. Please follow us on iTunes and rate us and keep sending me those emails. I love them. gthrush@politico.com. So without any further ado, here is Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. Well, yeah, I was just telling you, we had this incredibly arcane policy conversation about housing before we turned it on. Well, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so the first, let's start with the trivial. Do you do anything that's fun?
I play in the congressional baseball game.
That's not interesting.
Is that not fun? I'm the catcher.
Really?
Like that's a pretty embarrassing position to play.
Are you
in
the
that
catcher
game.
Because they couldn't put you anywhere else, or do you actually like it?
No, I'm the catcher because there's no other Democrat in Congress that can squat down and get back up again. So I got that going for me. No, everything interesting that I sort of used to do, or all my pastimes, kind of went by the wayside. The combination of being in the United States Senate and being the dad to a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old kind of squeezes most of your time away from from all of the other things.
Well, what did you do when you were an interesting person?
Back when I was an interesting person.
Before it all died.
I mean, I used to play lots of sports. I used to be a good tennis player. I used to be a decent golfer. I used to hike and camp and do all of those things.
Can I just say that you really are from Connecticut, aren't you?
It is, yeah, it's true. Yeah, if you hike and camp and play golf and play tennis, you fit right in. That's so totally. I didn't belong to a country club, so that takes away a little bit of the Connecticut stereotype.
Well, on a more serious note, in Connecticut, tell me if I'm recalling this correctly. I haven't read this in some time, but you were, if my recollection is right, you were at a firehouse not too distant from the Sandy Hook massacre.
Yeah, I was at the firehouse where all of the families gathered.
Now, was this happenstantial? Were you just there?
No, I was on a train platform actually in Bridgeport, taking my kids down to New York for the day to see the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree, and got the phone call that something awful had happened in Sandy Hook, and so I drove up to the firehouse, which was where the emergency response was happening, where all the parents had gathered waiting for news about their kids. And I was there for the rest of the day. And there are a lot of days that I frankly wish I wasn't there and wish that I hadn't seen and heard the things that I did. And I think maybe the only upside of it is that it makes me more personally and psychologically invested in this cause than had I not been standing with the parents as they were receiving that just god-awful news.
Just kind of going through, like, just in a narrative sense without getting into too much detail, but can you go through just a little bit about, so you're standing on that platform. Just tell me how the next few days kind of progressed and what you sort of remember.
Well, I mean, one of the most awful things was being in that firehouse and receiving phone calls from other members who had already been through these mass shootings, getting calls from Michael Bennett and Ed Perlmutter from Colorado to give me recommendations on, you know, the best way that I could try to add some value to the unfolding tragedy. And, you know, there is now an even bigger fraternity that probably encompasses the majority of the Senate and the House of people who have been through this. I mean, the advice that I got was to just be around, to just be at everything, and to actually try to be the public spokesman for all those families who weren't going to be in front of the cameras, but knew that there was an appetite in the media that needed to be satiated. And so, you know, I did try to be the spokesman for the people that were living through that tragedy over the coming days. And I'll tell you, it wasn't more than about 48 hours before the families, you know, who were in the middle of their cascading grief, you know, came to me and to Dick Blumenthal and others and said, you know, things have to change. We want you to work on this. And, you know, you try to figure out what the right point is to move from mourning to advocacy. Right. But for a lot of the families that we talked to that weekend and through the funerals and wakes of the next week, you know, they wanted that to happen pretty immediately.
Let me just ask you something, you know, of the moment, because we're obviously dealing with, I don't know how, 10,000 reporters and photographers and videographers here in Philadelphia. Was that your first experience dealing with kind of that a real media frenzy like that?
Yeah, I had just been elected to the Senate, so I was in between my election to the Senate and my swearing in, and you know, my race was fairly high profile. But no, you're never prepared for that. I mean, this was not just all of your national outlets, but international media converged on this tiny little town. I mean, this town of, you know, a handful, thousand people all of a sudden had to deal with the entire world watching. And
I've been on the other side of that, being part of the horde. What does it feel like? Does it feel like a little bit of an invasion?
Yeah, it does feel like an invasion. And I think everybody handled it appropriately. They knew that, you know, this was something different, that no one had ever seen this before. And so there was justification for the press being there. But, you know, as, you know, week one and then week two wore on, you know, people wanted to start figuring out how to put their lives back together. And that was hard to do with the media on top of everybody. I have to say, by and large, there were almost no incidences of, you know, members of the media going, you know, parents' houses or being too intrusive. And, you know, if you watched the way the cable news networks covered it, I thought they really did a wonderful job of expressing the humanity and some of the little minor miracles that did happen on the good side of the ledger during those weeks. So I think as intrusive as it was, you know, people frankly thought that Newtown got a fair look over the course of that week.
Well, you can tell me to jump in a lake on this. Was there anything being, you know, a lot of people run away from that kind of thing. Look, you were the senator from the state, and clearly you had a responsibility and you have empathy with these folks. But, you know, was there anything in your life that you'd ever dealt with that had prepared you for this?
No. And, you know, I can't say that I wasn't emotionally attached to the issues that I worked on. But, you know, this was something different, right? Right. In part because, you know, my son just graduated from first grade. I'm the same age as all of these parents. I mean, I could very easily put myself in their shoes. And so, you know, I walked out of that tragedy feeling like I had just been handed my mission in public service, that if I wasn't able in my career in the Senate to do something meaningful to pay homage to those kids and those teachers, then I had failed.
Well, that's really interesting because we had a good long conversation with Kirsten Gillibrand, who I've known for quite a while, probably around 3 months ago, in which she was talking about this. And I'd covered Gillibrand. I'd worked for Newsday, and I'd covered Gillibrand when she was a proud member of the NRA. And she really, you know, she really pivoted on that. But this issue that you're talking about, you know, people talk about finding themselves in life. Like, you know, I've got a nephew who's trying to figure out what he wants to do after he graduates school. Politicians have to do that too, right? Let me just ask you, before Newtown had happened, what did you think your calling would have ultimately? I mean, what is it that you thought the essence of your career was about before then?
Yeah, I mean, I had run for Congress on a platform of universal health care, and I ran against Nancy Johnson, who was the 24-year member of Congress, the chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Healthcare.
Pretty moderate Republican.
Pretty moderate Republican, yeah. But, you know, had written Medicare Part D and had, you know, was opposing all of the Democrats' efforts to extend universal health care. So I thought of myself as someone who's coming to Washington to work on universal health care. And of course, we did that during my time in the House of Representatives. And so, you know, I think in many ways, as I was being elected to the Senate, you know, I was certainly interested in defending the Affordable Care Act. But, you know, there wasn't one issue that was driving me to get up every day and go to work like there is today. And of course, you know, in the aftermath of Sandy Hook, I became really embarrassed that I hadn't paid attention to this issue, because not long after, I went to do a town hall on gun violence in Hartford. And, you know, the pastors and the parents there were furious. They were furious that all of a sudden the country had woken up to the issue of gun violence when they were living with it every single day.
African-American communities. It is the single most effect. You know, I've covered Hillary for a very long time, but I covered Hillary in the early going in Iowa. And, you know, she gave some lousy speeches in Iowa, but the ones that really resonated was when she brought the moms of the gun violence with her.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like, I think she really found her voice with that. And that's a community, as I think we saw in the primaries, particularly in New York and South Carolina, that gun issue is really resonant with black voters.
Yeah, because listen, these kids that are growing up in these neighborhoods like the east end of Bridgeport or the north end of Hartford, you know, they grow up with brains that don't work the same as ours do, because the stress levels that are induced by living in violent neighborhoods changes the biology of your brain.
Explain that.
Yeah, so by living in stressful situations, there are chemicals in your brain that are released that essentially degrade the neuron connections that allow you to function as a normal human being. And so studies show,
because you're fight flight all the time,
because studies show that kids who grow up in these neighborhoods have levels of PTSD that are worse than returning soldiers from Afghanistan and Iraq. And so you have entire communities whose biologies are being changed by gun violence, and for a long time they didn't understand why nobody was talking about that. It wasn't just the people who died or were shot, it was everybody else whose lives were being affected by living through that constant fear. And this issue for me has united these communities that are on the news, the victims of the mass shootings, and the urban communities who now feel finally that somebody is listening. And so, yeah, this is a passion project for me now, and I certainly conduct myself in a way on this issue, you know, the filibuster being an example, that I probably would have never done on other issues.
So it feels, you mentioned getting up in the morning. I mean, like, it's funny, but politicians, I feel that way when I'm working on a good story. When I feel motivated to work on something that I really enjoy doing, like, for instance, coming here and talking with you, it really motivates me it really gets me going in the morning. You don't think of politicians necessarily having that same sort of having that same sort of motivation?
Well, because there's just a ton of bullshit in this job, right? Yeah. There's a lot of reasons not to get up in the morning. There's a lot of things you don't want to do, right?
What and don't you want to do?
So, like, we don't want to raise money, right? We don't want to do all the things necessary to sort of preserve your political existence. And so you have to have these passion projects. And again, it's not to say that I didn't have them, but, you know, this one to me is black and white. I mean, there are all sorts of shades of gray when you're working on economic policy and tax policy and healthcare policy. There's no gray on this issue. To me, this is a gun lobby that is raging out of control, that doesn't even represent its own members.
You have a 90, what are the numbers? They're staggering. 80 to 90% of Americans of all parties want more robust background checks, right?
Yeah, there's no issue in which the American public is so clearly in one place and the Congress is so clearly in a different place. There's no issue where the advocacy organization is so extreme. There's no issue in which the emotions and the psychology are so raw. And so for me, there is just no brooking compromise on this. I wake up ready to fight, and I feel like I'm on the right side of history every day.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is I've got a lot of relatives around the country who view guns as being, I don't want to, it's crass to sort of say it is a religion, but I will say it is a faith. Mm-hmm. There are people, aren't thinking about this issue, they are feeling about this issue, right? Does that something, okay, so when you took this up as a cause, tell me what your encounters with those kind of folks were.
So I did about 5 town hall meetings in my state in the beginning of 2013, right after Sandy Hook, and all of the Second Amendment proponents came. I felt those sort of raw, very personal feelings that they had. But almost, none of them, when it came down to it, were opposed to the kind of things that they were talking about. Many of them thought that there was a secret agenda, that background checks was just a way to get to confiscation. And they had frankly been told that by a lot of these gun lobbying organizations. But if you told them that the only thing that was going to happen was mandatory background checks, they were willing to accept that. They just didn't believe it. They just thought that there was something else that was going to be step B, C, and D. And so I think that that's why these issues do enjoy broad support, why gun owners actually are sometimes the most enthusiastic supporters of background checks. Their opposition is not because they object to those things. It's because they think that there's something else going on here.
And the other thing about it is the NRA has actually been, I think what's underappreciated is they've been outflanked on their right too. Like there are groups that are more extreme than the NRA on this issue, aren't there?
Well, like Donald Trump. I mean, like Donald Trump, who suggests that the response to Orlando is to have everybody who goes into a nightclub be able to bring a gun and drink. And even Wayne LaPierre couldn't endorse that. I think there's this convergence right now of a gun lobby that has to deal with a changing industry whereby, different from 1978, when half of Americans bought guns, today only about 35% of Americans.
Is that true? Yet we have, yet the volume that each person purchases is increased, right?
So the model of the gun industry is very different. You've got to convince people to buy a lot of expensive weapons, which is why the NRA builds this paranoia about government, because they've got to feed this justification on behalf of a handful of Americans to buy lots of expensive weapons. And then you've got this phenomenon in the Republican Party whereby they are trying to out anti-government each other, right? So they have to prove how much they hate government, and they hate government more than their primary opponent. Well, there's no way to express how much you hate government better than arguing that your citizens arm themselves against the government. Right. So Republicans are sort of falling in love at a new rate with the gun lobby because that's a way to express their hatred for the government, that the government's so bad that the only thing that you can do to protest is to arm yourself in potential future resistance.
Well, it's a cultural signifier. I mean, it's a political and cultural signifier. I mean, it really is like, if you want to sort of divide people around the dinner table, you ask them sort of how they feel about guns. Another personal question, again, tell me to jump in a lake. Have either you or any members of your family ever been the victim of any kind of violence?
No. I mean, I've been lucky to have been immune from this epidemic personally. But again, that doesn't it doesn't mean that you don't feel this when you've come to know those victims like I have. But no, it's luckily not personal for me.
Well, that's good. So we had this situation in Orlando. How serious an issue here do you think are people getting inured to this stuff? It just seems like 50 is almost inconceivable. Like, you can't really wrap your head around that. I'll give you an example. Was it today in Fort Myers? Was it either today or yesterday? I can't even remember. Two people were killed. That was the number 14. I literally looked on my Twitter and I was like, oh, thank God that only two people were shot and 15 were wounded.
Yeah, and I'll be gone by this afternoon, right? Nobody will be talking about it after about 4 o'clock today. No, I actually think the opposite has happened. I think this new intersection between guns and terrorism and this confusion that has been created in the number of African Americans being shot by police and then the number of police being shot in the line of duty has really moved the needle on this issue. The polling that I've seen just in the last 30 days suggests that this is now not an issue where just 90% of Americans support it. The intensity level of people's views and positions is rising. And I think that's why you are seeing this week an entire night of the Democratic convention being dedicated to the issue of gun violence, not just because Democrats think it's the right thing to do, but because the Clinton campaign is seeing that in swing voter populations, for the first time ever, this issue is starting to pop.
So it's politically resonating.
It's politically resonating because there's always been compassion for the victims of mass shootings, but now people are seeing terrorists using as a very explicit tactic, using our loose gun laws in order to perpetuate mass murder. And they are outraged at this combination of shooting of innocent men in cities and the targeting of police officers.
When were you elected to Congress for the first time?
2006.
2006. 2006. So 2006, I'm going to throw this back at you, okay? I was covering the Hill in 2006. A fellow by the name of Chuck Schumer, I'm sure you're familiar with him.
I've heard of him.
A fellow by the name of Rahm Emanuel, you're familiar with him.
I am.
They took back both houses of Congress in 2006. And one of their strategies, and I spoke with both of them at length about them at the time, was muting the gun issue. So you had people like Tester and McCaskill, who were in states where gun ownership was extraordinarily popular. It was a concerted, coordinated move between Schumer and Emanuel to mute this issue. How big a mistake was that? And how much do you sort of hold your own? You know, I don't want to, you know, you can yell at Chuck if you want, but how significantly do you hold your own party accountable for creating an environment?
I hold myself accountable. I mean, I didn't work on this issue until Sandy Hook. It wasn't on my radar screen. And we're living with the consequences of an anti-gun violence movement essentially laying dormant from 1994, when this mythology was created that the assault weapons vote was what was responsible for the big losses that year until 2012. So essentially for 20 years, the anti-gun violence movement did not exist, with the exception of Carolyn McCarthy in the House of Representatives. During that time, the NRA built up this enormous political machine that beat us in 2013 on the background checks.
But back to the 94 thing, because it seems to me like, you came out of the womb with a political imperative. Tell me about this 94 thing. How much of an article of faith as a Democrat running in the Northeast was that? Was that imprinted on your brain that you keep away from the gun issue?
Yeah, I think that this was the third rail for Democrats, that we had been taught that we lost the House of Representatives in 1994 because of the crime bill. And I think you actually go back and read that narrative. Well, that may have been an issue in a handful of races, the health care vote and the general antipathy towards Clinton on a number of other issues was probably much more of the storyline. But yeah, as you were a Democrat getting ready to run for office in the 2000s, as I was, you were just told to stay clear of guns, that it really wasn't worth your time. And, you know, I really regret that. I regret having listened to that
advice. Wait, not to be a dick, but like Rahm would go into districts. I remember there was a documentary about it. Did Rahm and his folks say, Chris, don't do that?
No, because he didn't need to with me, right? I wasn't working on this issue and I wasn't paying attention to it even as a candidate. And again, I'm embarrassed, you know, by that. But I now in the district I was running in, you know, didn't include any of the cities in Connecticut with particularly high rates of gun violence. So had I been representing Bridgeport or asking to represent Hartford, maybe it would have been different. Yeah. But no, I in my case, you know, I certainly didn't need anybody telling me not to talk about guns, because I think I already had gotten that memo.
I think the people who listen to this show are continual learners. I consider myself to be a continual learner. That is why you need to sign up for the Great Courses Plus. With a wide variety of subjects, including history, politics, business, and more, the Great Courses Plus video learning service is now offering listeners to this podcast an opportunity to stream over 7,000 fascinating video lectures presented by award-winning professors and experts in their fields. You'll get a free month of unlimited access to watch courses like The Fundamentals of Photography and many, many more when you sign up to The Great Courses Plus. So start your free month now by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. That's 1 month free when you sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. Well, here's a bank shot. So Hillary started off her career. I've covered her for a long time. You know, she worked at the Yale Child Center, in which she was she worked on a book called Beyond the Best Interests of the Child, which is a landmark in child welfare research, right? And one of the elements of that was a very similar thing that you're talking about. I don't think they identified it as PTSD, but they talked about kind of the long-term generational impact of poverty on children. You know. What kind of conversations, obviously you have supported her for quite some time. Tell me about some of the conversations you've had with her about it.
I think that she and Obama are similar in that they have, you know, intersected at this issue at a very personal, emotional level. I think that, you know, watching these families in Sandy Hook, getting to know them, both of them have, I think has changed them on this issue. She was one of the first people to call me the morning after the filibuster to, you know, congratulate me and ask how she could help. She has been, you know, out front with the families of Sandy Hook since the very beginning. And yeah, I think it's a combination of her just feeling an emotional connection and her realizing that this has transformed as a political issue. Certainly, this was a way to create differentiation with Bernie Sanders in the primary. Yep. But a lot of people predicted that this issue was going to disappear for her once the primary was done. And it hasn't, A, because she is personally connected to it, and B, because it now has general election relevance in a way that it might not have just 6 months ago.
Hey, it's funny. You know, Bernie, I just thought of this. Bernie Sanders was out there today rallying his troops. And I thought he gave an incredibly effective pitch, by the way, and really, I think, gave a very good counterargument. But the crux of what he is about is how much he has moved the Democratic Party, the left, and the platform. Has Bernie Sanders moved at all on the gun issue as a result of what happened in the primary? He hasn't, has he?
Well, he has. So there are specific things that he wasn't for that he is now for.
Right.
So, you know, take the issue of restoring legal liability to gun manufacturers.
Right.
He voted to remove that liability as a congressman, I think, and he is now a co-sponsor of the law to return liability to the gun manufacturers. You know, he's always been with us on the issue of background checks. He voted with us in 2013. So, no, I think that this, you know, primary has moved him on the issue of guns. He was not part of our filibuster, but he did come down to the House floor to take part in the sit-in. I can predict that he probably wouldn't have been on the House floor prior to running for president.
The politics in Vermont don't work on that issue, right?
Yeah, and listen, this has become a litmus test issue for leadership in the Democratic Party. I mean, if you want to be a leader in the Democratic Party, I think this presidential election has proven that you have to be right on the issue of guns.
Well, I was in the White House right after Sandy Hook, and one of the really controversial things internally, and I may not be remembering the chronology right, there was a real push, I think, from some progressives to have Obama introduce this legislation immediately, like day or two afterwards,
right.
Dust it off, throw it out onto the floor. Instead, he decided to kick it over to Biden to do the commission. And again, if memory serves, that pushed it into the new year, into January. Was that a mistake? Should they have just pushed the button then and gotten what they could have gotten?
And it's hard to go back and hindsight this thing. Yeah, maybe in retrospect, we should have moved something to the floor much more quickly. Because if you remember in those initial days, you know, we thought we were going to get an assault weapons ban,
yeah.
Right? I mean, the idea that we were going to settle for a vote on a halfway background checks measure was inconceivable in December and January. All that being said, I mean, I know enough about this process to know that nothing comes to the floor that quickly, right. And that ultimately you do need a little bit of a process. But yeah, listen, what we did clearly didn't work. We lost some of the momentum that we had coming off of the tragedy. We gave the NRA the ability to go make their case to Republicans and conservative Democrats.
What are the two or three reasons that that was allowed to happen? If you're kind of like going back and diagnosing it, God forbid we have a tragedy of that scale again, the likelihood is we are going to.
Yeah.
But if you were in that situation again and you had a moment to put the pedal to the metal, TikTok for me, what went wrong in terms of the chronology of that to get the thing moving?
I think what went wrong is 20 years of silence from the anti-gun violence movement. I can tell you that maybe we would have had a better chance had we run the bill a little bit earlier, when the wounds of Newtown were fresher. But the fact of the matter is that we weren't ready for this moment.
Right.
I mean, the NRA was ready. They had been getting ready for 20 years, and we weren't. And so I'm convinced that no matter when that vote would have happened, under any context, we were likely going to lose it. And now our mission is to build up a national political infrastructure around anti-gun violence measures so that the next time we get a real opportunity, we don't miss it.
But how do you do it? So I guess the question is, and it's the same slamming your head against the wall question as there's always been, right? It's become such an entrenched cultural issue. With all due respect, you're a guy in a white shirt from Connecticut, right? Like, how do you get this to jump the wall?
Yeah.
How do you get people who are not necessarily, we saw, for instance, two phenomena that blow me away. Michael Bloomberg pays for ads, a complete backlash against that. Anytime Obama mentions anything about guns, the gun sales spike. I'll throw in a third one for you. Donald Trump says, without a smirk on his face, that Hillary Clinton is there to abolish the Second Amendment. All three of these things are
right.
To show you how inflamed the issue is. How the hell do you get any traction? Tell me where the gray area is. Where are the persuadable independents?
Well, again, what I'm looking at is polling that tells you that swing voters right now, especially since we've seen this intersection of guns and terrorism, are willing to vote on this issue. So you clearly have to get some electoral wins here, right? You have to actually show people that if they vote against 90% of their constituents, that they are at risk of losing their seat.
Right.
And in 2014, it was a terrible year for Democrats. So that was not going to be a year in which we were going to get a referendum on gun votes. But 2016, which looks like much more of a toss-up year, may give us those opportunities. So in a place like New Hampshire, right, we are going to have an opportunity to run an incumbent senator who voted against background checks against a Democratic candidate who is for them. And so I think you're going to have some opportunities to see whether this issue has political relevance. You're going to have two more referendums on the ballot for universal background checks in tough states, Nevada and Maine. You're going to get to test that premise there. And you're going to be able to make the case that this is a new tactic of terrorists, that these terrorist groups are now, instead of using airplanes and IEDs, they're using assault weapons today. And they are literally instructing their potential lone wolf attackers to go to gun shows and buy dangerous assault weapons. And so just like after 9/11, we decided to make it a lot harder for terrorists to get on planes, we should accept that cracking down on our gun laws, yes, will prevent more mass tragedies like Sandy Hook, will cut down on the rates of urban gun violence, but will also be a pretty effective counterterrorism strategy. That is a new way to message this that we haven't had in the past.
It's not just a new way to message, but the problem is the legislative process is broken down on the Hill. So in the past, you would have some form of some bill that included a compromise. So you had a terror bill where the Dems would give on something.
Right.
I don't know, domestic wiretapping, but of course the Dems love domestic wiretapping almost as much as Republicans, right? But in a normal functional system up on the Hill, you would have this as part of a package, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the problem is it's disaggregated. It's kind of laying out there alone as a solitary issue.
Yeah, but there are other ways to get there, and I think you saw that a month ago. I mean, our filibuster created room to have a debate that created room for Susan Collins to go out and work a compromise that came within a handful of votes of passing. So, you know, we do have evidence just in the last 30 to 45 days that there are pathways to get compromises on this. And I think in large part because Republicans see some major exposure in being out to lunch on this. You're also going to have Chuck Schumer as either the majority leader or the minority leader in the next Congress, somebody who is, you know, A, true deal maker, and B, cares about this issue in his DNA.
Right.
So I think that's a potential new opportunity in the Senate.
We should say he wrote the Brady Bill. And
So I think we accept that as an opportunity to get that kind of deal done that has not been available in the past.
Two more questions. I will let you go. This has turned into a very stern affair, but I mean, this is serious stuff. Kind of circling back to what we started off with, do you still keep in touch with the families? Is there any particular family that you are close to?
Yeah, I do keep in touch with the families, the Bardens and the Hockleys and the Greens, the Wheelers, the Richmonds. I mean, I keep in touch with a lot of them, and they're all doing different things. You know, some of them are involved in the anti-gun violence cause. Some of them are off running foundations and charities in their children's names. But yeah, I mean, I feel like they're the measure of my progress, right? I mean, if they feel good about what I'm doing, then I feel like I'm doing a good job. And it's sort of weird to have this, you know, this awful, terrible, tragic focus group, right? This group of parents who you feel like if they support what you're doing, then you feel like you're doing a good job. If they don't, you know, then you have to recalculate and recalibrate. But yeah, I keep in touch with them.
Have they ever given you shit on something? Like, you need to be doing this, you need to be doing that?
No, I think there's times at which they wanted me to be fighting harder on this issue. I think they were all very disappointed that, you know, the initial debate in 2013 turned into, you know, just a vote on background checks instead of assault weapons. But, you know, no, they've been very kind to me. And, you know, I've tried to keep them updated on everything that I do.
So let's go back to the firehouse a little bit and kind of conclude with that. Just tell me a little, in slightly more kind of granular terms, just give me a sense as to what are the one or two memories you have from that experience that, and you don't have to name people's names, but what really, like when you close your eyes at night, what images do you see?
The image that I remember is the image of Neil Heslin. So Neil Heslin's son, Jesse Lewis, was killed. He's divorced from his wife, and he frankly didn't have a lot going on other than Jesse, who was his only son, and really the reason that he got up every morning. And he dropped Jesse off at school that morning, and Jesse told him on the way in, as he left the car, he said, "Dad, everything's going to be okay." And it was a non sequitur. It had nothing to do with the conversation they were having. And Jesse walked out and went to school, and Neil never saw him again. All the parents left that day, you know, after they had heard the news and they went home, and Neil didn't. I just remember, I didn't know who he was at the time, and I've gotten to know Neil well since.
Can I just ask a stupid question? What does he look, give me a physical, what does he look like? What's he like?
Neil's kind of a grizzled looking, you know, guy with kind of a, you know, working guy accent, you know, who, you know, he's a tough dude. And
what does he do for a living?
I don't know what he's doing now, but he didn't move. Neil just sat there all afternoon and all night. He just sat there at a table, and he didn't move, and he didn't leave. And, you know, we all went over and patted him on the back and told him, you know, we were there for him. And I just remember that solitary guy. And he came before the Judiciary Committee and testified about Jesse and about their interaction before he walked into the school. And every Father's Day now, I go down to the Senate floor and I read Neil Heslin's testimony before the Judiciary Committee describing the interaction with Jesse before Jesse walked in for the last time to Sandy Hook Elementary School. Just as a reminder that in the end, you know, this is people's sons and daughters, their dads, their mothers, that this is as personal as it gets. And it's a hard testimony to read. I can almost remember it by rote at this point. But that's what I remember from that day.
Well, why does he think I don't know if he's the kind of person that would have expressed this, but if he were to guess, why does he think his son said that?
You know, there are all of these. I think people take from that day what they need to take from it. You know, Daniel Barden never got up before his brother ever. His brother left for school before he did. And Daniel Barden that morning got up early and ran down the driveway and hugged his brother goodbye for the first time the entire school year that morning. I mean, there are all of these things that happen. That are probably coincidental,
that
right?
They become statuary.
But they become statuary. Yeah. They become the way in which you remember that day. And you know, whether you believe in God or karma or not, you have to figure out how to manage through these crises. And these little things have become ways to deal with it. And I don't know, this is just stuff that I would have never, ever thought of.
Outside of your realm of experience.
Yeah, like totally outside. I mean, listen, I'm blessed in that, like, I have not been the subject of personal trauma or tragedy. I grew up in a pretty economically safe, physically safe household. And, you know, now my life is defined by other people's trauma and by other people's emotional experience with it. And I think I'm richer for that.
I remember Obama coming into the briefing room, and I remember there was a real moment where Obama teared up. It was a pivot point. I believe it was the pivot point in his presidency, right? Question that people have asked Obama, I'll ask you. Well, first of all, were you a particularly religious person before this happened?
No.
Are you a particularly religious person now?
There's something about all those stories, right? I mean, I don't think that all those things are coincidences. I struggle with religion, but I got more of it, not less of it, coming off of that.
So you feel something about those experiences that's a little different.
I do feel something a little different. Of course, it's hard to believe in that there's a God in this world who would allow that to happen. So there's a big part of living through Sandy Hook that makes you question the kind of faith that people practice. But at the same time, there were a number of those stories that suggest that there's some higher power out there that you have to at least consider.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience. But listen, have a cup of coffee or something to cheer up after this. Well, listen, I appreciate you taking the time.